We're in Proverbs chapter 1, starting in verse 20. Can't get my Bible to cooperate tonight. Proverbs 1, beginning in verse 20. We'll read down to the end of the chapter. Take this hunk tonight. Wisdom crieth without. She uttereth her voice in the streets. She crieth in the chief place of concourse, in the openings of the gates. In the city she uttereth her word, saying, How long, ye simple ones, will you love simplicities? And the scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. Turn you at my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit unto you. I will make known my words unto you. Because I have called, and ye refused, I have stretched out my hand, and no man regarded. But ye have set at naught all my counsel, and would have none of my reproof. I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh. When your fear cometh as desolation, and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then shall they call upon me, but I will not answer. They shall seek me early, but they shall not find me. For that they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord, they would have none of my counsel, they despised my reproof. Therefore shall they eat of the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices. For the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. But whoso hearkeneth unto me shall dwell safely and shall be quiet from fear of death. Well, there we have it. Let me get my remote. Here's our topic of tonight. A parable of wisdom, which is the section that we're in. It runs down to the end of chapter 9. It's a long poem extolling the notion of wisdom. Somebody, I was going to say, who wants to be a wise guy and tell me what wisdom is? What? How would you define wisdom? Take a crack at it. What's the difference between wisdom and knowledge? It's applied knowledge. It's the skill, the skillful employment of knowledge. It's how to do something. It's not knowing what to do so much as it is how and the time to do it, the right way to do it. It's all of those things wrapped up in the idea of wisdom. The old adage is, how do you get wisdom? Well, what is wisdom? It's making wise choices. How do you learn wisdom? By making bad choices. inevitably, that's part of the process, is that wisdom, as we're going to see tonight, is something that is born usually out of experience or learning from the experience of others. And it is a whole lot easier on us if we learn from others' experience than having to go through the whole process ourselves. Does that seem wise that it would be, for instance, people get hurt in car wrecks when they don't wear their seatbelts? You want to learn that from somebody else, or would you rather learn it on your own? You can learn it either way. It's certainly a lot easier on you if you learn from the experience of others. And one example. The idea is that here is that wisdom is being extolled. It is something that is worth seeking. It's greatly valued. And the interesting thing here is that in this section dealing with the extolling of wisdom, it really doesn't get down to the details of what wisdom actually says. It's more about extolling wisdom. I remember running into some preachers that constantly talked about the gospel, how the need to preach the gospel and wonderful God. The problem is they just never got around to explaining what the gospel was. The gospel is a message, and we talk about the importance of the message, how you can't be saved without the message, how you need to have the message preached to you over and over again. But you can do all of that and never get around to explaining the message, the content of the message. And here we have the same thing going on with wisdom. We're going to spend really the first part of Proverbs talking about how wonderful wisdom is, how important it is, how you need to get it, how you ought to be seeking it. But we're really not going to talk so much about the Proverbs itself that comprise that wisdom. And I guess there's a method to the madness in that first of all, you need to be convinced that it's worth seeking, that it's something important that you need to apply your heart to. Now, notice in this section, and several times in the next chapters, you're going to see this, wisdom is personified. Now, if we're going to ask you the genre of literature that this is, what would you say? What would be your reply? What type? Is this historical narrative? It's prose. And by prose, what do you mean, Darren? Poems. It's poetry. Did y'all like poetry and literature? I see Jody back there shaking her head. I think, Jody, you're a lone wolf tonight. I detest it. I got really excited about studying poetry till I realized that not all poetry rhymes. You know, I thought this would be fun, you know. And then read all this stuff and none of it rhymed at all. I can't figure why do they call this poetry? I would have to say that my appreciation of poetry is probably a little more now than it was in my younger years, but I really had not much use for it. It just seemed to be a sort of a verbal exercise in how can we say the same things over and over again, the same, using different words each time. And a lot of Proverbs is like that. You're saying the same things using different words. Now, when you're dealing with poetry, what does that tell you? If you establish the genre of this proverb, what do you expect when you're dealing with something that's poetic, figurative speech, as opposed to literal? Figurative as opposed to literal. In other words, you're going to be, when you write poetry, you let your imagination run wild, right? And you use these flowery descriptions. I'm thinking of the Psalms where David will describe God coming in a storm or the earthquake and so forth. It's as you say, descriptive language that's generally, it's over the top. It's hyperbole. It's overstating. We're not intending for you to understand this literally, but by using the language we use, you get a notion of the meaning we're trying to convey. Now, why do I say all that? Because right off the bat, we have wisdom, the concept of wisdom, which is a rather abstract thing rather than concrete thing, but wisdom is personified. Notice wisdom is crying in the street, yelling out. Wisdom is not just personified, but strangely enough, personified as a woman. I shouldn't have said strangely enough. But in this case, wisdom is seen under the type of a female. And notice that what's happening is that this is sort of an attention-getting device of language to draw you in, to sort of paint a visual picture. I mean, we can talk about wisdom as an abstraction, and it's sort of hard to get your mind around. But when you see a woman, if you can visualize this, as the city, the village, and here's this woman out in the street yelling out, it gives you a way to get your mind around what is trying to be conveyed. That makes sense? All right. Well, we'll see that as we go here. So we would call this poem In Praise of Wisdom. And we could say that there are other places in Scripture where we have certain topics that are extolled sort of in a poetic form. For instance, on Mother's Day, just last Sunday, we read Proverbs 31, which is in praise of the virtuous woman. That description of the virtuous woman, would you say that's literal or poetic? Poetic? What'd you say, poetic? Why would you say poetic? Why couldn't you have a woman do those things literally? Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. You don't see the thing. You got to personify it. But let's talk about that virtuous woman for a moment in Proverbs 31. And you're saying, why, Sherry, you said, you got your work cut out for you. I mean, what is being described in that chapter is what we would call superwoman, right? I mean, there may be a woman somewhere that matches up to all of those qualities. But, and perhaps you as a woman, I don't know how women think. Amen. There's a sermon right there. But as a woman, you may be greatly discouraged that you read that and you just don't measure up. I mean, this is Superwoman, and man, am I failing. I mean, I don't even come close. This woman's up overnight weaving clothes for her kids, you know, and keeping them warm in the wintertime and all this stuff. And here I am, I'm barely getting the dishes washed, you know. But I think that's one of the things to keep in mind, that this is a poetic description and it's not meant to be understood literally. It is an ideal, as you said. It's the ideal. We have, for instance, another place where something like that is extolled. In 1 Corinthians 13, we have sort of a poetic description of love. It's sort of in praise of love. In this case, is in praise of wisdom, but you have all of this varied description about love. It's looking at it from every angle. Hebrews 11, you have sort of a description in praise of faith, the faith chapter, where you have all of these examples of faith. In the same way, you have many examples in that chapter, tons of them. And no one had it all, but it gives you, they all together sort of complete the picture. Well, you're getting the idea that that's why you employ this rhetorical device of using a metaphor, using this personification, in this case wisdom. Like Eleanor said, you can't see wisdom. It's an abstraction. But when you personify it, all of a sudden we can sort of visualize what's going on here. All right? In praise of wisdom, it is a poem. It stresses the importance of heeding wisdom, that is, listening to wisdom. And here we see this personification. It is personified as a woman, as I said a moment ago. Now, there's a reason for that. It has nothing to do with the fact that women are naturally wise, okay? I know what some of you are thinking. What would you, got a hint, a clue, Janet? Well, we're in Hebrew. Sophia, or Sophia, is a Greek word for wisdom. But the reason is exactly that. Both the Hebrew term for wisdom and Sophia, which we use as a woman's name, Sophie, is in Latin, or in Greek, is the word for wisdom. And both of those are feminine nouns. Now, in English, we really don't have gender. Almost every other language does. And it's really sort of strange that English is such an exception. We used to have some exceptions. Hurricanes used to be female. Ships used to be female. And now we got the USS Ronald Reagan. You know, where did that come from? And the thing is, gender, I remember having a conversation with D.A. Carson about this, and he was saying our problem is we try to relate gender to sex, and it has nothing to do with sex. Gender in language is strange. He said there are some African languages that have 13 genders. I'd hate to be having to learn that, but I can't even imagine that, 13 genders. Last time I checked, there's only two sexes, so, you know, they've greatly complex. For instance, in Spanish, you have el this or la this, depending on whether it's masculine or feminine. But the word for masculinity is masculinidad, which is feminine. The word for masculine is feminine. In other words, the genders don't follow the rules of what we would think. And why is a table, you know, la mesa, why is a table feminine? Who knows? El burro, why is a donkey male? Well, don't answer that. There are certain ones that seem to fit, others that don't. So, in Hebrew, the word for wisdom is a feminine noun. So, if you personify wisdom, it makes perfect sense to personify it as a woman. And notice that it is a woman who is out gabbing, talking, and not talking quietly. What this is doing is painting the picture. You explain this to me. What is the picture in your mind? What's going on? What scene, what setting is this? Notice the woman, if we look at where she is, she's in the opening of the gate. She's out in the streets. Where do you get your news today? I mean, used to everybody watch 6 o'clock news. Hardly anybody does anymore. Off the internet. A lot of people, I've gotten to where I don't even subscribe to a paper. I used to get the Memphis paper every day and I was just throwing it away because I get news off the internet. In other words, in the ancient world, and that's the idea, we're not painting a picture here of a woman out in the streets in the modern world. This is the ancient world. And in the ancient world, there are certain places where you exchange news and you have a crier who cries out the news. Typically, you would have a messenger that comes to town from somewhere else, maybe from the king or so forth, and stands out in the middle of the square and shouts out the news. Or in this case, notice she's either in the streets or she's in the gate. In the ancient cities of Israel, the gate was where you did your business. It's where you negotiated things. So this was a very common practice to go and shout out some important bit of information. And that's the picture, that's the scene that's here before us. Now notice, yes, Oscar. That is, I'll mention that in a minute, that this is a passionate crying out. This woman is into it. This is not just a job for her, but this is a crying, a pleading with a sense of urgency, as you say. It's very similar, like you're saying, the city's on fire. There's a problem, and I'm trying to get your attention for you to address that problem. I think that's a good point. So we're going to look at four things. Wisdom's call, wisdom's offer, wisdom's warning, and wisdom's promise, found here in these verses. The call is to the simple. Now, by simple, I explained this a few weeks ago, doesn't mean sophomoric. It's the idea of inexperience. In other words, the simple person may be brilliant, but they may be inexperienced. They hadn't been around the block, as we say. They've never gotten out much. They've got a lot of book learning. They know the facts, maybe, but they don't know what we would call wisdom. And so notice that the first cry here in verse 22 is, how long, ye simple ones, will you love simplicity? Why would you, if you're simple, would you want to remain simple? Now, Paul at one point says, I would have you wise to this, but I would have you simple concerning evil. I don't want you experience. You say, well, I got to get out there and experience everything. No, Paul says, I would have you simple as far as your experience of sin is concerned. But here, when we're talking about wisdom, the idea is that wisdom needs to be given to the simple. And that may explain why so few people seek it. Because notice, the prerequisite to seeking wisdom is to know you ain't got it, is to recognize the lack of it. And so this would say, it'd be like me saying, okay, all you redheads. And you say, well, I'm not redhead, so that doesn't apply to me. In this case, all right, you simple ones, and you're saying, wait a minute, I'm not simple. I've got knowledge. I'm a smart cookie. And that may well explain why so few people heed the cry, because she's calling to those who will acknowledge that they are, in fact, simple. That's exactly, come, you think of how often the gospel call is qualified. Come unto me, ye thirsty. Those that are hungry, those that are weary, needing rest. There's a spit. And that's exactly right. It's to get your wits about you to realize there's danger out there. If you're not in danger, no reason to watch. Oscar? Yes. Leave us alone, let us alone. Yeah. Then they walked on water getting out of there. Yeah. Well, you're exactly right. You begin to see that the way the cry is phrased is that this is for a particular type of person who understands they don't have wisdom. Notice as well, and this is what I mentioned a moment ago, it's a call that's public, loud, and passionate. All those things are describing the call of wisdom. All right, let's go to wisdom's offer in verse 23. Notice that she says, "Turn ye at my reproof," and the words in verse 22, "How long will you love simplicity?" implies that she has been crying for some time. In other words, she has been resisted in her pleading. But notice the offer is that even though you have ignored her, she will give it to you when you turn and ask. That's sort of interesting. That you may have been a fool for a long time, but if you will turn and ask her, she will give you wisdom. Notice she will give it very liberally. Look at verse 23. She said, "I will pour out my spirit unto you." This is not a niggardly parlaying it out here. This is generously filling you up with it. It's basically saying, "I'll give you all you can take. I'll pour myself into you." All right? Now, here's wisdom's warning. It's the longest part of this, running from verse 24 to verse 30. But here you can see certain things. Number one, she says that, "I called and you refused. I stretched out my hand. You didn't want what I had. You didn't seek. You didn't turn. So, when your calamity comes," and notice not if your calamity comes, but when your calamity comes. And that's interesting. In other words, there is a day of reckoning for the foolish, for the ignorant, for the simple. And it's just a matter of time till things catch up to him. Now, he may get away with it for a while. In fact, we'll see that in just a minute. But notice that there is a day of reckoning that is going to come sooner or later. And so when that day of reckoning comes, you will then cry to me. You will want wisdom on that day. But I'm not going to respond. I'm going to laugh at you. I will mock you. Now that's cruel. You know, here the day comes when you need wisdom. You recognize that need. And in that day, what does she do? She says, "You're going to reap the consequences. You're going to call unto me. Your fear comes in verse 27. Your fear is going to come. Your destruction comes. Your distress comes in anguish. Your fear comes as desolation. Your destruction comes like a whirlwind, tornado, we'd say, when distress and anguish come upon you. Then shall they call upon me, but I'll not answer. They'll seek me early." In other words, they'll get up early that morning wanting wisdom. "But they shall not find me because they hated knowledge. They did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would have none of my counsel. They despised all my reproof." So she will laugh and mock them. Now, here's the warning. That was the warning. Do you think wisdom is simply being cruel here? Being basically saying, "Okay, you ignored me, so I'll ignore you. I'm going to give you a dose of your own medicine. I'm going to, you mock me, so I'm going to mock you." Is this tit for tat? Is this quid pro quo? Is wisdom just a mean old gal? She's just. But it tells you something about wisdom. Is that we want instant everything. My cousin talked me into getting a box of old-fashioned oatmeal. I've been eating oatmeal. I'm on an oatmeal kick every morning for breakfast. I mean, you can get a whole box of this thing. It'll last you a month, and it's $3. That's what? 30? That's a dime a day. You can't beat oatmeal when it comes to being cheap. It costs me more for the butter I put on the oatmeal to make it edible than it does the oatmeal. Well, she said, "You're going to love," you say, "don't get that instant stuff." I've been getting the instant stuff. Don't get that instant stuff. You're going to love the old-fashioned stuff. Well, let me tell you, I don't love the old-fashioned stuff. I have to wait an additional minute and a half for that old-fashioned stuff to cook. I want it, and I want it now. You know, I want my oatmeal instantly. And so I'm going back to the instant oatmeal. It only takes a minute and a half to cook a bowl of instant oatmeal. We want everything instantaneously, right? But wisdom, and this is why I'm thinking that wisdom here is not just being ornery in a day of calamity. When that day comes, you're going to want wisdom, and then I'm not going to give you any. And it's not just these being stingy. It's the fact the nature of wisdom is that it can't be had instantly. It's at the end of a process, a long process. And the point is that, yeah, you want to wise up one of these days when the calamity comes, but it's a little too late then. There's not time to apply yourself to wisdom. So that wisdom really is a long course. It's not passing a pop quiz at the end. It's taking the course. And so we've got to apply ourselves to wisdom, this wisdom that's going to come from the words of God Almighty. We don't get wisdom by staring at our navel or staring at the stars. We get wisdom by receiving the words of God. So that takes time. That takes practice. It takes application. And so wisdom is just one of those things by its very nature that can't be had instantly. You know, let me have instant wisdom. It's like, give me patience now. Tim? Get to high ground, yeah. They got wise a little too late. He's saying about the tsunami and the Samoans, where the elders saw the waters receding, realized there about to be a tsunami, but the people on the beach said, oh, what a great time to go out and collect shells. You know, the waters are moving away, so now we can get out there. And well, they did learn wisdom. They just a little too slow. Animals are wiser than people. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Well, the point is that there's a lot of things. Let's take the day of judgment, the day of wrath. We have the idea that you remember Jesus tells the story about the foolish virgins who were waiting on the bridegroom. When he comes, the door is shut, and then they begin to knock. And I remember O.E.W. Johnson used to say that you can't tell me that lost man can't seek, because look what happens once the door is closed. They're seeking. They're knocking. But it's too late. The door's been shut. There's a sense in which preparation needs to take place for the day of reckoning, for the trouble that comes. When the tornado siren's going off is not the time to decide you needed to build a storm shelter, right? It's a little too late. You do that in preparation. And that's the way wisdom works. All right, let's look at this last thing, the promise of wisdom. Wisdom says, and another sort of warning here, ignore me and you will ultimately be destroyed, but honor me, heed me. And notice the two things you'll have. You'll dwell safely, and you'll be be quiet from fear of death. It's interesting that these are the things in the New Testament that are promoted for the Christian to live peaceably and quiet lives. Remember that in 1 Peter? And pray for your leader so that you can lead peaceable and godly, quiet lives. Peace and quiet is not bad. That's a good thing. Now, Peter will go on, as we'll see, to say, but if that's not what you get, if you are required to suffer, even though you've done nothing to disturb the peace, if you suffer according to the will of God, in other words, simply because it's God's will, suffering like Job, then suffer patiently and so forth. And so this doesn't mean that everybody who does everything right is going to live peace and quiet life. Trouble may come anyway. The Lord may deem to try you and test you as he did Job. But the normal course of life is that you're prepared for trouble. You're not staying up at night. You're not tossing back and forth on your bed because you've made preparation. And here the preparation is applying your heart to wisdom. So that's the, you get a sort of a sense of this first section. We'll not take every chapter between here and chapter 9, but I just wanted to give you a sample of what this section is like. Poetic, personification, and notice that keeps on. In chapter 2, verse 1, notice, my son. It's like a mother talking to her son. In chapter 3, verse 1, my son, forget not my law. So we're still having the picture of this woman who is speaking, in this case, to a son that she's instructing. And, of course, the young person falls into the category of the simple, again, not because they're stupid, but simply because they're inexperienced. They haven't had the exposure. They haven't had the trials and the testings that older people have had. I remember reading that wonderful, monumental work of insight called All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes. It really was one of the most interesting books I have ever read. And in which this fella who used to be on public radio had written this, he just pointed out that in ancient cultures, old age is extolled. I guess I'm thinking about this now that we're sitting around the table talking about how old we are, that, you know, in Japan, in the East, you honor old folks. And you honored them because they had a store of wisdom. Now, here in the West, if you see a TV sitcom, the old person doesn't know zip, you know. If you want to program the TV, you go get your five-year-old, right? And there's a sense in which we are living in a weird age. In the ancient world, the old was considered better than the new. Because let's say you've got an old chair, an old rocking chair, and I make you a new rocking chair. Which one is more valuable to you? Well, you need to choose the old rocking chair because it's lasted. You have no clue whether the new rocking chair is going to last or not. The old one has proven itself. Well, in today's world, it's exactly the opposite. You get you a new washing machine, and it can do all of these other things that your old washing machine couldn't do, and especially your phone and your computer. The new is always better than the old in our modern world, and that is a reversal of things that has been here from thousands and thousands of years, that we're living in a very, very peculiar age where the youth is seen as the brilliant. I mean, you need to break into a bank, go get you a teenager. He can do it with his cell phone. That's the way the movies portray things, that youth is where the knowledge is. The old guy, especially if he's a father, he doesn't know zip. You know, can't even tie his shoes. And that is a complete reversal of the way we've been taught to think about wisdom from Scripture and from culture from early on. Okay, if we think about this in particular in relationship to the gospel tonight, because the gospel is, after all, called by Paul the wisdom of God. And so notice that the same things are applicable that we talk about wisdom in general, is that wisdom is calling, crying out. But the same problem is true of receiving the gospel as our wisdom, in that we already think we know it all. We already think we've got it. Why? We're not hungry. We're not thirsting for righteousness. We've already got righteousness. We don't need life. We've already got life in the sinner's mind. And so, first of all, you see the gospel is only going to come to those who see their need of it. But the gospel is crying in the street, and the gospel makes the offer that if you really want me, if you're really hungry, if you're really thirsting after wisdom, I'll give it to you. I'll pour myself into you. I'll fill the old song, fill your cup, Lord. I'll give you an overflowing cup if you truly want me. But don't wait till the last minute. Don't wait till the day of judgment. Don't wait till the day you die. Apply yourself to wisdom. So you see how these things do translate over to the New Testament and the pursuit of wisdom.